Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
So it's raining here a lot.
I hear that. I hear you have deluge-like conditions.
Yeah, there's a lot of rain here. How's it going there?
It's snowing here.
Ooh, snowing, you say?
Quite a bit. Several inches started this morning. We're supposed to get like 8 or 10 inches, I think. A lot of snow.
Okay, so explain to me how snow shoveling works.
I am surprised that this is a concept that difficult, because essentially it's, you know, anything you do with shoveling where it's like you want to move it from one place where you don't want it to another place.
Okay.
Where you probably also don't want it.
All right, but it's funny when I see you guys on the East Coast talking about snow shoveling, and it's like, okay, so where don't you want it? Why don't you want it there, and where don't you want it? And why do you shovel it when you shovel it?
Okay, well, there are a few reasons. Specifically, you probably don't want it in a lot of places where, say, you might want to walk, like sidewalks.
Okay.
So sidewalks, your front steps, your front path, or whatever, like any place where people are going to be walking, because snow is not only inconvenient in terms of being wet and gross sometimes, but it can also be kind of slippery.
So now the city, does the city, like, come around and clear anything?
The city does streets. They will plow streets depending on the extent to which they get plowed really depends on where you are. I have had lived on side streets that don't get very plowed at all, but most main thoroughfares are probably better cleared, and you have cars often, you know, if there is traffic, cars going up and down them will, you know, by virtue of friction and the like, will melt some of that snow.
Right.
They also tend to salt roadways that are more tasty. Most roadways, yes, delicious road salt. Don't eat road salt, it's not good for you. They tend to do that. It helps melt the snow. Some places use sand, but I think that's kind of out of favor in a lot of places, because it just then gets like goopy and has to get washed away somewhere,
right?
So yeah, but they don't do sidewalks. And if you have, say, a car parked on a street or in a driveway, it may be covered in snow,
uh-huh.
and it may have snow blocking it from getting anywhere. So you have to shovel out your car.
When I was in Boston, this is a long time ago now, because it was when my sister-in-law was in law school. I remember walking past a car that was, I mean, it was encased in snow.
Oh, sure.
And I remember thinking to myself, that car is just going to be there for a long time. Just,
no, I mean, maybe. It depends on how vigilant you are about shoveling out your car. Most people, I mean, it doesn't take, you know, I've shoveled out a couple of years ago. We had a particularly bad winter here, and we had multiple snowstorms with like multiple feet of snow. And I mean, you know, it takes time to clear out a car, but it probably doesn't take more than an hour or something like that. But you have to be careful. Shoveling is actually fairly dangerous depending on many different factors. I mean, you know, just from sort of an injury standpoint,
mm-hmm.
snow, especially wet snow, can be pretty heavy. It's a good way to put out your back. And on a more serious note, the snow, shoveling snow, because it's so heavy, requires a lot of exertion. So if you're somebody who is, you know, maybe not in the best shape, it can be pretty tough on you. And people die a frequent amount from, like, overdoing it, from like heart attacks and the like.
Right, so a friend of his had a heart attack while shoveling snow in Minnesota, and was in the ER and then in the ICU for a long time.
It's a lot of work, and as with any sort of exertion, if you jump right in, like, it's not so good.
So you should not do snow. You should not have snow. Why do you still have it? Stop.
I have written to my senators.
Okay, all right, good.
I feel very strongly about this.
Good.
But still, it seems to keep coming.
And yet still the snow persists.
Well, you know, everybody wants to say something, but nobody wants to do anything about it. Isn't that always the way?
So, okay, so what you're doing, I'm not done yet. What you're doing is clearing paths that wouldn't otherwise be cleared, because you don't want... you don't want to walk on snow, because it could get in your way, or it could be slippery and dangerous. And when there's a lot of snow coming down, you want to do that frequently, so that you, what's the idea there? So that you don't have to instead do massive amounts. You're afraid it's gonna you know, melt and refreeze and be icy. What's the end game here?
All of those things are concerns. In that depends on the type of snow that's coming down. It depends how much you care about, say, people who might be out walking in the snow and might have to walk through your unshoveled sidewalk and then possibly slip and fall, which, of course, raises liability issues. And it also, depending on the weather and how it's going to progress throughout the day, you know, getting rid of it before it is frozen underneath, which definitely happens. You know, it definitely, especially as you shovel things, oftentimes the underneath layers turn more liquidy. And right. then if it gets cold, those can freeze over again. So a combination of all those factors are important when it comes to shoveling. Now, the biggest problem, if you live someplace like me in the in sort of a more urban environment, is that where do you put all this snow?
I was going to ask that next.
This is actually kind of a issue that comes up a lot because there are fairly limited places where I live to dispose of snow. You are generally told not to shovel the snow into the middle of the street because then it essentially becomes problematic for cars that want to go through.
And the snowplow is just going to come and throw it back in, onto your sidewalk, right?
Yeah, and in fact, actually what happens, and I learned this growing up, shoveling my parents' driveway, was that once you have cleared the mouth of a driveway, the snowplow eventually comes along, and then it just pushes all the snow, and as soon as it finds an open spot to push the snow, like, oh, look, there's driveways. Like, it just sort of flows off the sides, right? And it just blocks up all the place that you just cleared. In my city, there is a snow emergency parking where a snow emergency is declared by the city. And that means you can only park, in many cases, on one side of the street. So one side of the street gets left clear. And usually that's because then the snow has someplace to sort of pile up. And they open up municipal lots for people to park in and stuff like that. So it basically gives a chance for you to find a place to put the snow or get rid of the snow in the meantime. But I would say that most people where I live, snow goes in the yard. That's where it goes if you got it. Or on the, if you like, you end up with these little bunkers of snow on like the curbs. You know, basically, you know, a little like pile, there'll be like a path shoveled on the sidewalk, but on the sort of little curb berm area, you'll often have like these giant piles of snow, or you'll have piles of snow between like in front of and behind cars because people will have cleared out their space, but there'll be again like these like risers in between the cars because people just make piles of snow because there's really no place else to put it.
Right.
And so a few years ago when we had that particularly bad snowstorm, there was a pile downtown of snow that had been shuffled out.
And didn't melt. It was still there until like July.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of snow and there's not a lot of place to put it. And they don't like doing certain things like, so you can't just shovel the snow into, say, Boston Harbor because your snow might have like crap in it basically. And so then you're basically throwing stuff into the water. Like because people, you know, trash gets buried underneath snow, stuff just gets like subsumed by snow and sometimes it doesn't get caught. And so they just plow it all up.
You got all that
plus
salt.
It's full of salt. Yep, exactly. So a lot of times they just trying to find places to, you know, like there's like an empty lot that it was in with that was that giant pile of snow, but you'll see it in parking lots a lot of times in like large open.
Well, that was
when
I was visiting you that winter, and I was staying at that hotel in Natick, and, the back parking lot of that place. Cause we went to dinner and it was at a place like right across the street. So I walked across the parking lot of the hotel to get to it. And, I walked past the giant pile of snow that was, and it wasn't snowing then, but there was a giant pile of snow in the back parking lot of that hotel because they needed some place to put the snow, and there it was. It's just as a, and it's not like it didn't snow where I grew up. It did snow where I grew up, but rarely.
You don't get volume like this.
Rarely. It would do it, you know, we would see snow a couple of times a year, and it would accumulate at any, like, sizable amount beyond a fraction of an inch, you know, once every few years. And it was rare that we even had a snow day. That happened, you know, a handful of times in my entire childhood. So, and in places like that, of course, you know, it's sort of like in the South when they get a snowstorm.
Everyone freaks out.
Or London, you just like forget it and that's it. Right. And you stay, you shelter in place.
There's no infrastructure.
Exactly.
I mean, when I lived in Scotland, I remember there would be like a dusting of snow and the people who lived in the dorm with me were all student teachers and they'd be like, snow day. And I'm like, you're kidding me? This is nothing back where I come from, but there's no plows and they don't know how to deal with it. And so you know, rightly so. It's just people worry about causing way more in the way of accidents. And even here, I think we tend to poo-poo, you know, we watch videos of people up in like the Pacific Northwest or whatever, and they get that like inch of snow or half an inch of snow and the cars are sliding everywhere. And we kind of laugh about it. I mean, nobody wants anybody to get hurt, but obviously sometimes you think, oh, those people don't know how to drive in snow. And, but you know, a lot of that is not having the experience or the infrastructure dealing with it. I mean, like when I was a kid, I remember walking to school once in the snow on like a bad snowstorm, and I remember like being able to like skate on the grass because the grass was all frozen. But it differs. I mean, even here we had some snow earlier in the week and then it froze overnight and the next morning we had black ice.
I don't
know if that's a thing that most people are familiar with, but essentially, you know, a layer of ice that you can't see. And
that's actually more common here because we get rain in California. Yeah, you get rain and then the storm moves out. And if it's like a Gulf of Alaska kind of cold winter storm, because we get both kinds, we get the tropical winter storms and the cold winter storms, that behind it, it can be very cold. And that sheen of, you know, water freezes overnight. And then you get up at 5 a.m. and you try to drive. I mean, it doesn't stay frozen at 11 in the morning, right? But in the early morning, you get the black ice, and it is the worst because it's invisible.
Yeah, I woke up and I turned on the radio and I heard the local news guy saying, like, more accidents than we can report out there. It's like, yeah, all right. But it's, you know, the worst I think I feel like I've ever really experienced in some ways was a few years, maybe like a decade ago, I was out visiting a friend in Chicago. And it just is so, everything's so wide open there. And it does really get bitter cold and you get like the wind and stuff coming off the lake. And I just remember driving him. I had to drop him off at the airport and I went on an exit ramp and I saw a line of cars sort of backed up on this ramp. You know, it was like a little flyover and I was like, oh crap. And so I hit my brakes and the car just like skids and like, I'm like, oh man. And so I'm like steering and, you know, amazingly, as my friend said later, he's like, you know, I thought we were pretty good and not going to hit the car in front of us, but I was 100% certain we were going to hit like the barrier on the side. And we didn't hit either, which was amazing. And on the way back from driving him to the airport, I must have passed 3 or 4 accidents, including fire engines at a couple scenes, like, you know, people who skidded off the road and whatever. It's just, it's so cold and so flat. Like there's no there's nothing blocking anything. I don't know. It just seemed very desolate to me and really tough to deal with up there.
Yeah. Wow. Well, California, come out to the coast. We'll get together, have a few laughs. It's just rain here.
In the rain.
It's 59 degrees and raining. That's all it is.
I'm surprised. So the rain gets bad enough there that you're like, your kids aren't going to school.
Yeah, we have
raining too much.
2 days this week. So some of that, I don't know. It has been a little windy today. It was a big storm on Tuesday when they closed it. And it's a combination of things here. This is the weather edition of the Six Color Secret Subscribers podcast, by the way. It's a combination of things. There are parts of my county that have more sort of like narrow roads that have trees that go down on them and things like that that can make access for people getting around difficult. And we're right here on the water. And so like in my town, there are if there's a lot of...
flooding.
Yeah, we're by a mountain and we're by the bay. So when rain comes down, the creeks all fill up and then there's a high tide. And the high tide is extra high oftentimes because the bay is full of water from everything else that's flowing. And that all comes together. And so there are parts of where I live that just they flood when there's a lot of rain and a high tide, especially, including the street that runs in front of my daughter's high school. So yeah, I got a note like not too long ago on Twitter from the and I got an email too, and it's like, you know, high tide's gonna be at 11 o'clock, and you know, and the street right now, Miller Avenue, is shut down the whole way from the traffic light in front of high school all the way down.
Just like, you know, just like load up the kayak and like paddle over to school.
Probably could today. It's flooding, and there are people, there are a lot of places, not really where we are, but there are a lot of places that do occasionally flood here. So it's all of that. I think there's sort of prudence of like the water is so high in so many different places that it's going to be hard for people to get around, potentially dangerous.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah,
but
yeah.
Still, it's pretty extreme for this part of the country to have take a couple of days off of school kids because it's
common for us,
much.
But.
We don't have snow days built into our schedule, right?
Right. Yeah. Different thing. I was going to say something we got here, which we got earlier, and this is the second time I've seen it like in the last 2 or 3 months, which is crazy, is thunder snow.
Oh, I've heard about that.
thunderstorm during when it's snowing. Like, instead of being like raining and thundering and lightning, you get lightning and thunder in the snow. It's weird. I feel like I've seen that much more in the last year or two than I don't remember ever seeing that when I was a kid. But, you know, it's bizarre. Understand. Crazy weather.
It's crazy. Let's go inside. Why don't you tell me about what happened, what you did to your house?
The house is no longer standing, Jason. I've removed all the walls. It's very cold in here. A lot of snow.
You should shovel.
I should shovel inside my house. It's true. I don't actually, for what it's worth, I don't often shovel my walk or my steps because I have a landlord and that's his job. But I do shovel my car. Anyway, so yes, I discovered that if you've invested just a very small amount of money in home automation, home tech, Internet of Things style stuff, turns out you can do a pretty passable job of emulating certain aspects of your favorite Starship. So I basically made it so that I can use my Google Home to say red alert. It will change the lights in my office and my living room to red, and it will start playing the red alert klaxon sound. Now, I've been trying to do this for a while using my Echo. I thought it would be a fun little dumb thing I could do, and it's taken me like probably about a year to get it working right.
Some people would say, like, hey, on the spur of the moment, I decided to do this, and you're like, nope, I've been thinking about this one for a long time.
Oh, I have been rolling it around in my brain, because, you know, you got to get to be right. Like, you know, very early on when I had the Echo and the lights, it was a pretty simple matter to just, you know, give a command and make the lights turn red. That's easy. You can do that with, you know, very little. And so what I wanted to figure out was, you know, is there a way to A, tune that keyword better? So rather than having, say, like, Jason, I know you've complained in the past, for example, that when you do anything custom with the Echo via IFTTT, that you have to use trigger as a keyword.
Right.
It just feels clumsy. It's not ideal, but it's pretty much the only way that's supported. And so I at one point investigated even building a skill for the Echo, which is like an app, because they have some simple versions. But even the simplest version was like a bit beyond the capability. Like, it was just going to be so complicated. Like, I was basically gonna have to write like a little program, and my programming days are long behind me. And so I kind of gave up on it. And then I found some other home automation style, like there's an app called Yonami, that kind of does some home automation stuff and can work with multiple different types of technologies. And I played around with that for a while. It was okay, but I figured out that it would, like, it was still, I still had to say, like, turn on red alert. And that was kind of a mess. And then when I added last year, I added a Sonos to my setup, and I realized after playing around with it a while, like, oh, I could actually make that, because that has some hook-ins with home automation stuff, maybe I could make that play the red alert sound. And I tried that, and the problem was it kept ending up like super delayed every time I started trying to use it, and like using this Yonami app to try and like send that instruction, the lights would turn red. In the Yonami app, I could make them also blink several times, but then they would finish blinking, and then the sound would play. And it just felt very, very clumsy and very disjointed. And so I kind of gave up on it. And then I was writing an article about the Google Home for another site, and realized that the IFTTT integration for it is incredibly robust. I was surprised how good it was. You can just create any command whatsoever. Any arbitrary phrase can be linked to something, and they even have options for phrases that include variables that can get passed along to the resulting actions. So it's really powerful. And so I thought, well, naturally, I thought, let's turn this back towards my nerdy pursuits. And so the trick ended up being, as I wrote up in my article, using the Harmony Hub, which I know you have one of as well.
Right.
Because essentially that's a hub that contains not only, you know, built into its hardware, like a little hub that connects via Wi-Fi and then can talk to other things via IR or even like internet protocol, essentially. And so it can talk to the Sonos, among other things. And it can also, it has a tie-in with Philips Hue stuff and other home automation stuff. And so basically what I ended up doing was creating an activity within there that when triggered would send instructions to both the lights and to the Sonos all at the same time. And so I then basically just made a Google Home IFTTT script that launches that activity on the Harmony Hub and it works pretty well. There's a little bit of a delay, as there is with anything that's like basic, because it's going out routed through the web and then coming back in. So you're always going to have a little bit of a delay. But it's not bad, and it works close enough together that, like, so a couple of my cousins were over this morning. We took a stroll over to celebrate National Bagel Day and go get some bagels, and then we came back, and they're like, so wait, so what can your house do? And so I demoed it to them, and they thought it was pretty hilarious. And then on the way out, of course, they were, like, yelling at it to trigger as they were leaving. So they left me in my house by myself with Red Alert going off.
So essentially, though, what you're saying is that the limitation of if this, then that means that you need to use the robustness of the Harmony Hub.
Right, because the problem with if this, then that is that it only triggers a single condition and a single action.
I know.
And so
it kills me.
You'd have to, I mean, I imagine that you could do some crazy things with chaining where things are triggered. What was it? I read some automation thing where a guy had set something up in which it was triggered. Oh, you know what it was? It was the guy who figured out how to make the Google Home and the Echo talk to each other in an infinite loop. And it basically involved setting up a calendar appointments. And so we would ask, like, what's on my calendar? And one of them would respond, like, you have a calendar item that says, like, hey, lady, what's on my calendar? And then it would just keep going forever. And so it's like, all right, there's probably some clever things you could do with some sort of, like, you know, chaining IFTTT actions into each other. That would then let you do more complex workflows, but it's just kind of a mess and a hack at that point. So yeah, you'd need something a little more robust if you really wanted to carry out multiple actions. I feel like this is something that home automation is kind of missing, is like, and I played around with this in a variety of settings, but it feels like there are all these hacky solutions, like, you know what I mean, and if this, then that, that help you glue some of these things together, but they are fairly light on, you know, power features,
I wish if this then that just added the ability to have, well, first off, multiple steps, and second, conditionals. Because I've had to do that too, where, like, you know, I have a, I have some scripts that fire on my weather station. And they allow me to do things like, actually, my weather station console, my inside console, is in my bedroom, and I want to have a dehumidifier go on and off in the bedroom automatically. So the weather station knows the humidity in the bedroom and can control the dehumidifier. It's great. But I have to do that in a script that is fired on my Mac server that uses the weather station, that then fires if this, then that, because it needs to check what time of day it is, because I don't want the dehumidifier turning on at 2 in the morning. And it's just a thing that if this and that, I wish it was that much more sophisticated, so that you could say, you know, if this trigger launches and this other thing happens, then do this thing, or then do this, and if the result is this, do that. And again, yes, that's more sophisticated, but basic conditionals are only somewhat more sophisticated, and you could totally do it. And it is a frustration, because if this and that is so good in as a tool for this stuff, but it's just so dumb. And the office assistant devices, your Homes and Echoes and things, those, you know, are also kind of dumb in that they're not going to give a bit of sophisticated output. They're basically going to ping a web service somewhere and say, here, and then let the intelligence do it. Like, their goal right now is basically to just be the voice interface that kicks off an event. But if the web interface is dumb and it's dumb, then all you can get is dumb output, unless you filter it through something that's smart, which is why, yeah, it's great that the Logitech Harmony Hub lets you set that up, but that's really dumb that that's how you have to wire it, right?
Yeah, I mean, and I ran into this problem. I think I wrote a piece last fall about the, I bought the Philips motion sensor. Because I was interested in having more inputs, right? Like, I have the Echo and the Home as, like, inputs, things I can give commands to, but it seems silly that there isn't, like, some, like you were talking about with your weather station, that there's not a way to get more ambient information and use that to make rules, right? And so I tried to set that up, but its interface is extremely limited in what it can do, because it's tied to, for example, like, it has behavior enough to know whether it's night or day and can trigger differently based on that, but it still ties the same, like, end result to both of them. So, for example, like, I think the problem was, like, it has only one condition for after a certain amount of time elapses. So, for example, I could have a trigger and turn my light on, and then I could say, if there's no motion after 20 minutes, you know, turn the light off again. But a lot of the problem is, like, sometimes I think to myself, it's kind of dark today. I would like my office light to automatically turn on and realize it's because it's a little too dark. But the problem is I'm sitting in my office, and a lot of times I don't make enough, or I'm not in range of the sensor in order to move significantly, so like 20 minutes later it turns off again because I'm just sitting in my chair.
Yeah.
And if I turn it off, if I say don't turn off once you've been turned on, then the problem is that, like, even if it gets triggered at some time, it stays on like the rest of the night or something dumb. Like, and so it's like, this is dumb.
You know,
like, this could be solved with more complex rules.
I feel like now, I hope that we've got some really serious venture capitalists out there who listen to the Six Color Secret podcast and are happy to wait 20 minutes in after we talk about weather to get this idea. But here's your $1 million, $1 billion perhaps idea, which is, if I think there's a business in building the equivalent of IFT or the equivalent of Automator for the amalgamation of smart home control triggers and intelligence. Because right now it's all over the place, right?
It's like, all over the place. Programming, totally fractured.
Like, because the Logitech thing is great, but you're using the Logitech app essentially to build that thing out. And that is a bad place to put that kind of logic. And then it's just this great amalgamation. So if this, then that could probably do this. But let's just pretend that they're not going to, because maybe they're not. I feel like maybe there's something here. Honestly, it's probably something that Google should just do. And Amazon should just do. But failing that, maybe there is a business here that is creating that, you know, that web service where everybody goes to and they put in their in-home devices and of all kinds, their home control stuff and their voice assistants and all of that. And then they're able to do programming that is not computer programming, but is fairly basic, you know, give them a dashboard, let them do some basic kind of conditionals. And again, that's a little bit nerdy, but I think I got to think that there's something there.
Well,
because there's a huge need, and it's just not being, it's literally not being fulfilled by any party in this.
Well, and here's the big problem is all of these, they all work on their own protocols. Now, the advantage of having a web service in the middle of it is that they want to work with as many things as possible. This is why I started using that Yonomi app after a while, and that's why I like IFT, because they don't necessarily have a, you know, horse in that race. They want to talk to as many different services as possible. And Google and Amazon are doing this a little bit, but then you throw in HomeKit stuff and it's like nothing's ever going to get everything, right? Like, because HomeKit works on an entirely different system. And so you need some sort of glue in the middle that's going to let you address all of these devices. And sometimes the devices themselves are, you know, promiscuous in terms of what protocols they support, right? Like, Philips devices work with pretty much everything. And that's because they have a bridge in the way for the Hue lights. But the problem then becomes, like, you create these rules, and I've described this in the past with some of my home automation problems, is that certain tools, like, for example, the Apple's Home app lets you define automation rules that run on your Apple TV. But the problem is it's fairly limited in what criteria it gives you for these things, and it doesn't work with all the devices. And so I set up some rules there, but then it won't do things a certain way, and so I have to set up rules in another app. And because this thing is sort of decentralized, I now might have 6 different apps I have to check to figure out which rules are firing. And that's just terrible. Like, that is an incredibly un-user-friendly experience. And, you know, maybe most people will stick with just the home app. And if they can't do something, they'll say, throw up their hands and go, oh, well. But, like, that sucks, too, because now you're not getting the most out of all these devices that you've spent money on. So having a third party in there, you know, to let you make these more complicated workflows and to have everything centralized in a single place seems extremely beneficial to me, but I'm not sure how plausible it is, especially when you add in the fact that, like, a big thing with HomeKit, obviously, is security, and Apple has worked very hard to make sure that all this stuff is secure and you know, can't be hacked. And as a result, I think we end up with a system on their part that is much more proprietary than a lot of the other systems, because they're actually enforcing strict security rules, which a lot of these other things don't. I mean, you know, the Philips Hue Bridge has a web interface that you can log into, essentially, that's like an HTML browser form, and you can just like issue commands through there. And that's all that the, you know, API is doing, really. So, yeah, there's it's all kind of a mess right now. And that's one reason I think that home automation is only slowly taking off, is that it's easy to set up one or two things, but when you get to the point where you want to make stuff more complicated, it's very hard.
Yeah, it's the I don't want to advocate for the vendors like Amazon and Google to be the ones to build something like this, because of course they will build it all and it will be for their product, and everybody will have to be a partner and build it for them, and then they're gonna have to turn around and build it for the other guy too. I would rather it be someone that can create like a nice center space for all this stuff, because again, it just annoys me now. That maybe in reality, that's just not how it's going to be. But I think we've reached a new point in the smart home world where we've got a lot of the stuff now. The problem is not that the stuff doesn't exist. The problem is the stuff doesn't talk to each other. Yeah. It doesn't coordinate. It doesn't all coordinate, right? I mean, HomeKit versus not and all of that. And and it doesn't do a good enough job of interconnecting and using information from the right. web to be intelligent. Right. And then the other thing that I've complained about in Six Colors and on this podcast before, which is the also I'll throw in there that the dumb voice activated devices, your Google mm-hmm. Homes and your Echoes, they need to be smarter in terms yeah. of interactivity, which means that their APIs need to be more robust, and ideally they'd be able to talk to some of these outside web services, and that's again a thing, and be trained too. I mean, that's a thing that you should be able to do, is you should be able to say, you know, somehow, whether it's in an app or even by voice, like a lady, you know, in the Echo, what I want you to do is tell me the temperature. And it's like, well, this is the temperature. It's like, okay, when that temperature is yeah, below this, exactly. trigger this thing. And again, not a thing you can do. So, you know, there's that. But it's funny because I feel like the first step was like, do these things exist? It's like, got it. They exist. Now they don't do enough.
Sophistication is the next yeah. step. I mean, you're totally right. The yeah. being able to issue rules via voice would be huge, right?
Wouldn't
because
that be great?
That's how you
right.
do things, right?
Hey, like, lady, wants to yeah. when the humidity in the bedroom is above 40%, turn on the dehumidifier. Okay.
Bam. You're done.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. When I say red alert, turn the lights red and play the sound.
Yeah, right?
That would have solved so many problems for me.
Right? Wouldn't that be great? I mean, yeah. I know there's a lot of complexity hiding behind there, but again, it scales, but I don't see, you know, that's the next step for this stuff, and I don't see right. this stuff really
yeah,
going
I mean,
there yet.
And I love that it is at the hacky stage right now, because I feel like for people like you and me, that's kind of a sweet spot, in the same way that, like, you go back 20, 30 years for computers, right? And we were all trying to figure out how to like make all these things talk to each other and do all these complex tasks. And to the point where today, yeah, that still happens, but it's much less common. Like, there are fewer tasks that we need that done for. And so the computers have become very user-friendly in that way. And, you know, now we're kind of on the cusp of this new type of interaction, new type of hardware. And so, like you said, it exists, and we're in a stage where people can sort of make it do things, but it requires a lot of know-how and hackiness. But I, you know, seem given the way that evolved, I think if you look, you know, a few years out from now, this is compared to something like VR or AR, this stuff is all incredibly doable. Someone yeah. just has to do it, right? Like, yeah. VR and AR is stuff that it's like, we haven't quite figured
well,
out
that,
how these
still
things
in
work
the,
yet.
This stuff needs to exist mode, right? Whereas
exactly.
this is like, okay, stuff exists, but now
and
we
this
need
stuff
to do
is all very
it.
Dumb, right? Like, nothing here requires a high degree of sophistication.
Well, that's the funny thing about this stuff is, like, if you've got dumb stuff that's connected to the internet, and you've got the internet, it's very clear what the next step is, which
sure,
is
right.
something in the internet needs to be smart enough to tell the dumb stuff what to do. And yet, I don't see it. Like, I just don't see it. So, you know, maybe we'll get there, but it hasn't happened yet. I don't know. All right. We should wrap this up. Thanks to everybody out there for being a subscriber to Six Colors. We appreciate it. The lights are still on for now until the rain intensifies or the snow intensifies because of you. So thank you. And Dan, stay warm and keep shoveling. Sure.
That is what it said on those World War II posters.
Indeed.
And stay, Jason, stay dry.
I will. Goodbye.
Bye.